Well, we're going to continue our study tonight in the book of Genesis. So, if you have your Bible and you want to turn to Genesis, this would be a good time to do it. Genesis chapter 25. We're halfway through. 50 chapters in Genesis. So, this is the halfway point. And we've been able to maintain our course here and cover a chapter each time we look at this. So, we're doing okay. Does this seem loud to you? Or is it... Oh, is it okay? Okay, never mind then. Why don't we just jump in? I guess, maybe I should give a little background of where we were last week. Last week, remember, we were looking at the story of how Abraham sent his servant, an unnamed servant, who we assume is Eliezer, sent him out to Abraham's family back from where they had come from to find a wife for his son Isaac. And we looked at the beautiful analogy that can be drawn from that. We looked at what a servant's heart is like. And we mentioned last time that we're coming to the end of Abraham's story. Tonight we will deal with the end of Abraham, literally. And that's basically, by and large, what chapter 25 deals with, and then the kind of the following action that comes from that. So, if you have your Bible, if you want to turn to, I've already said that, turn to Genesis chapter 25. Let's read verses 1 through 6 to begin with. It says, Abraham again took a wife, and her name was Keturah. And she bore him Zimran and a bunch of other kids. Verse 3, some more kids. Verse 4, a bunch of more. Verse 5, and Abraham gave all that he had to Isaac. But Abraham gave gifts to the sons of the concubines which Abraham had, and while he was still living, sent them eastward away from Isaac his son to the country of the east. All right, I got to be honest with you, I'm going to probably be skipping through these names. There's really no point in not only me trying to do these tongue twisters of names, but in going over that. All of the Word of God is inspired. It's all His Word. It's God-breathed. But I also think that there's, especially in a study like this, really no point in getting you guys more sleepy by bogging you down with just going over these names. That basically what we're looking at is the series of children who go out towards the east, and that's the last thing it says about them. He's sending them out towards the east to the land of Arabia. And so that's we understand more. The basic point to that is understanding the origins of these Arabian nomadic tribes that lived in those areas and to this day actually still live in these areas. So here we're coming to the end of Abraham, and he's we've been through a lot with Abraham. When you think about it, we've gone through a lot of adventures with him. We've done a lot of things, and we've seen what the Lord's done in bringing him to the place that he's at right here. And in some ways, there's almost a sadness about this. You know, Abraham gets so much attention through the Word, and it's kind of a sad thing to actually have to get to this point where he passes from the scene. But the writer here, Moses, we believe it is also kind of wrapping up his information on Abraham. He's giving us all the other tidbits of knowledge that we need to have, explaining about the other children that Abraham had. I got to tell you that when you first read this and you look at this and you think, Abraham married again to this lady named, Keturah, and he has 6 kids by her. And remember, Abraham is 100 some years old. I mean, you think this is one intense dude. I mean, this is amazing. You'd think, he'd done his bit for God and country, but he clearly has something going on. Actually, the thing about it is more than likely, the 6 children that were born to him by Keturah were born to him before even Sarah had died. Because in 1 Chronicles 1:32, it describes Keturah as Abraham's concubine. And a concubine is someone with whom a man cohabitated with who was not his wife. We would call her a mistress in our vernacular today. So he had other concubines, other mistresses. This is one to whom he had 6 children born to him. And apparently after Sarah died, it was kind of a successive thing. She became then his wife. Now, I know that as New Testament Christians, we sit here a little bit mystified going, what's up with this? You think about Abraham and Sarah, and we got kind of misty-eyed about this wonderful, beautiful, loving relationship they had. And in our in our westernized minds, you know, those two were together and there was the brief little thing with Hagar and that was a mistake and they learned their lesson and they went back to the way things were supposed to be and stuff. And then we get to this part at the very end and here's Abraham's got concubines and stuff and all these other kids and it's like you kind of get a little weirded out. But the thing we got to remember is the context in which this is being written. You remember, this is an Old Testament account of the patriarch. Remember what's happened here. What this should do is remind us and help us to recognize what has happened to mankind. You know, mankind was created in this perfect environment, in a sin-free environment. And when he fell, and the earth was so corrupted that God had to recreate it. He destroyed it and recreated it in the flood. We see that mankind has fallen into such darkness that God has literally got to lead mankind back to him. Basically like infants out of a foggy darkness. He's trying to bring them back. And there were things that God, in essence, winked at that he allowed to that degree because his spirit wasn't yet indwelling a man like it is in this dispensation. So in understanding this and understanding this about Abraham, we've got to view it with that in mind. We have a tendency to view everything as a New Testament Western Christian, and we can't always do that, especially in light of these patriarchal characters here too. So, we realize as Christians, as believers whose hearts have been changed and united with the Lord, we look at the fullness of his word that he's provided for us, and we can go back to Genesis and view with renewed minds and renewed hearts what God said at the beginning to Adam and Eve, you know, that the man should leave his father and mother, the two should become one flesh. And we know that that's God's desire and his plan for two people to have this union, not six people or eight people or whatever, but two people. And that's something, you know, that the Lord has had to bring people to. You remember it was even an issue in Jesus' day as they were questioning him about certain things like that. So, we don't want to be hard on Abraham on this, and I know it can kind of throw you for a loop, but he was still God's servant, and we have to put it in the context that it was in. So Abraham, when he's settling all his affairs, of course, he does as Eliezer had told Rebekah he was going to do. He gives everything that he has, all of his wealth, all of his riches to Isaac, but he gives gifts to the guys that were born to concubines, and the gifts must have been pleasant enough because you don't see any kind of grumbling mentioned here or anger or hatred, though, you know, you never know. Maybe that is some of the roots behind the animosity that still dwells between Israel and the Arabian people. But he sends them out and he separates them. He wants there to be a clear separation between Isaac, who is still dwelling in the regions of the promised land that he believed God had given him, that the Lord had promised him, and these other sons who were not the sons of promise. So he wants to keep a clear distinction with them, between them still. Well, let's keep reading here, verses 7 through 11. This is the sum of the years of Abraham's life which he lived, 175 years. And Abraham breathed his last and died in a good old age, an old man and full of years, and was gathered to his people. And his sons, Isaac and Ishmael, buried him in the cave of Machpelah, which is before Mamre, in the field of Ephron the son of Zohar the Hittite, the field which Abraham purchased from the sons of Heth. There Abraham was buried, and Sarah his wife. And it came to pass, after the death of Abraham, that God blessed his son Isaac, and Isaac dwelt at Beer Lahai Roy. Well, back in Genesis chapter 15, in 15:15 actually, God promised that Abraham would live to a ripe old age and would die in peace. And of course, as we see here, that came true. That's what God promised him. That's what God provided for him, a long life that he was able to enjoy on this earth. And he settled all of his accounts, as we saw, before he passed away. And it's interesting because he probably called Ishmael to come to him. He probably was aware that he was dying. And so he called, you know, and in that kind of an environment, it was a lot, you know, they were a lot more realistic about things like that. You know, we put that kind of stuff off. We never want to talk with parents or anything like that about, you know, when they're going to die or arrangements or anything. But there's a certain peacefulness to this. There's a certain acceptance of this in this culture. And clearly he's aware that something's going to happen with him. He's not going to be here much longer. So he calls for Ishmael to come out. And I think it's very interesting that you see that there's a certain peaceful interaction to at least the degree of burying their father between Ishmael and Isaac, who were not getting along all that well before that. But they were able to come together now, and they were able to bury their dad, and that's kind of a cool thing. And he's buried there with his wife, Sarah. And so there's kind of a neat closure to that whole story that God provides about Abraham. We have to realize that this chapter is not necessarily chronological. In other words, the events that we're reading about in this chapter are not necessarily sequential, one happening after the other. We're kind of going backwards and then forwards because he's dealing with issues here. First, he's dealing with Abraham, wrapping up all of his affairs with his family. We're dealing with who his children are and where they went. And then we're dealing with his actual death and burial. But we're not necessarily doing it in the order that it happened, because it could throw you off. I mean, it's just like the whole Kedjara thing could throw you off. You could think that, you know, Abraham had 6 kids after Sarah died, but I'm not convinced that that's the way that was. I think he's just telling about the various things that happened during that period of time, but it's not a sequential kind of thing. Because the way this is written here, it could almost sound like Abraham died before the events of the verses that are going to be coming up here later on, the birth of Isaac's sons. But we know that's not true. His sons actually Isaac's sons must have been around 15 years old when Abraham died. Because Abraham, we understand the chronology here, Abraham was 100 years old when Isaac was born. We remember that. And then Isaac was 60 years old, we'll find that out, when his sons were born. And Abraham died at 175. So you put all that together, the kids must have been around 15 years old when Grandpa passed away. And so this guy's adventure finally comes to an end. Abraham's story comes to an end, and this sojourner who's been traveling through this region for over 100 years. He's been traveling through this land that God said that he had promised to him for all of this time. I mean, over 100 years, guys. You got to think about that. That is a long time for him to be going on this promise that God gave to him. All this time he's traveled, and yet still he was a stranger and a pilgrim there. At the very end of his life, the only thing that he actually really literally owns is the grave that they bury him in. That's the only thing that he had actually to show for all of this time. But Hebrews tells us that the patriarchs to whom God made these promises to, these patriarchs died in faith, not having received the promise. It could seem kind of discouraging if these patriarchs were only looking for a geographical plot of land, if the promise to them even only represented a certain amount of dirt that they could say belonged to them. But I don't believe that's true. I believe they even if they didn't know how to express it, even if they didn't fully comprehend it, I believe that they understood some measure, some sense that what God was calling them to in this promise and what Abraham believed in this, I believe, at least according to Hebrews, is that he was looking for a city whose builder and maker was God. He was looking for a dwelling place with God. He was coming out of the darkness looking for that light. And according to Hebrews, he receives it anyway. According to what we know, even in Luke 16, we know that Abraham is in paradise. It says that when the poor man dies, he's gathered into Abraham's. When Lazarus dies, he's gathered into Abraham's arms. So there's a sense, whether that's a parable or whether that's a literal thing that happened, you know, that debate, I'm sure, will just rage on. But the fact is Abraham is represented there in paradise, in the presence of God. So even though he died not having received the promise according to the way he foresaw it coming to pass, I still believe there was something in Abraham's heart that was cognizant of the fact that God was calling him to a special dwelling with him. And that's what God is providing for all of us. You know, the stuff of this earth passes away. Abraham passed away. But there's something more. There's something eternal that God is drawing us towards. That's a beautiful thing. Excuse me. All right, let's read verses 12 through 18 now. Now this is the genealogy of Ishmael, Abraham's son, whom Hagar, the Egyptian, Sarah's maidservant, bore to Abraham. And these were the names of the sons of Ishmael, by their names according to their generations. The firstborn of Ishmael, Need a new name. verse down to verse 16. These were the sons of Ishmael. It's all these guys in between here. And these were their names, by their towns and their settlements, 12 princes according to their nations. That's important to read and to remember. Because remember what God prophesied was going to happen according to when he met Hagar and Ishmael out in the desert. He was going to be the father of kings. And these 12 were prophesied that were going to be coming from him. Verse 17, these were the years of the life of Ishmael, 137 years, and he breathed his last and died and was gathered to his people. Verse 18, they dwelt in Havilah as far as Shur, which is east of Egypt as you go toward Assyria. He died in the presence of all his brethren. So this is just a follow-up on Ishmael. You know, we dealt with Abraham, we dealt with his sons, now we're looking at his firstborn son and, you know, keeping track on what's happening with him. And it shows that what God promised would happen, it comes to pass. He's the father of these 12 tribes, and he and his people and his people after him dwell in this huge expanse of land between Egypt and Assyria, which for many, 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 many years was always traditionally referred to as Arabia. And these were the Arab peoples, nomadic peoples who lived in there. They're still there to this very day, though on the west bank of Israel, there is a certain segment of those people who are now referred to as Palestinians. And they are in conflict to this day with the sons of Isaac, who are the people of Israel. So the conflict that was there between Isaac and Ishmael way back when that happened earlier in our study continues on today. And there's no love necessarily between the two of them yet. Let's keep reading here, verses 19 to 21. This is the genealogy of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham begot Isaac. Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah as wife, the daughter of Bethuel, the Syrian of Padan Aram, the sister of Laban the Syrian. Now Isaac pleaded with the Lord. Here we are in verse 21. Now Isaac pleaded with the Lord for his wife because she was barren. And the Lord granted his plea, and Rebekah his wife conceived. So here we get some more information on Isaac. He was 40 years old when he and Rebekah, so that's the story that we were reading last week. We realize Isaac is 40 years old when he finally meets Rebekah and they get married. And in verse 21, we find something very interesting about Rebekah. Rebekah is barren. Isn't that amazing? You think about the similarities that are developing here. I mean, this is just like what went on with Sarah. Here's the son who's going to carry on the very promise that God gave to Abraham that your offspring are going to be more than can ever be numbered, like the sands of the shore, like the stars of the sky. Your descendants are going to be that numerous. And so he gets a wife, and what happens? She's barren. So once again, we're faced with this apparent impedance to the promise being able to be fulfilled right off the bat. That's, I think, to me, I don't know if you sense it or not, but I feel the unspoken struggle that exists under the surface of this. You realize when we talk about this promise, you know, we're not talking about just the promise that God made and how this all fulfilled, but we're also describing here a war that's taking place. There's a battle that's raging in this. And we sense it right here. The very thing that was plaguing Sarah, that she couldn't have a child, and God broke through and brought a child of promise, the very same thing happens again with Rebekah. And Rebekah now is faced with the same thing. There's a fight going on. There always is a fight going on. The Bible is a history of a war. It's not just a clever collection of quaint sayings or a nice philosophy. This is a history of a war that's been taking place that still rages to this day. When God promises something, when God purposes to do something, there's opposition and there's a battle that rages as a result of it. It seems like, you know, the story of a couple, a young couple who are trying to get pregnant, you know, and have a kid. But it's more than that. And the stakes are incalculable. But I love Isaac's response to this. There's a war that's raging. There's a battle that's raging. Something is impeding the promise of God from coming to pass in their lives. But I love Isaac's solution because it's the right one. Because when he and Rebekah come to this barrier, Isaac prays. He beseeches God. And this is a good lesson for us because it reminds us that even though we have propositional promises that God gave us in His Word, there is a battle that rages whenever we endeavor to see those promises realized in our own life. Just because the promise is there doesn't mean there's not a war associated with it. Just because God promised it to us doesn't mean that there's not a battle that's going to ensue. And I'll tell you, we need to remember this. We need to pray, appropriating the promises of God. You know, it's so easy for us to look at what God says in His Word and we see how He promises us these blessings associated. You know, He says, peace. Peace I give to you. Not as the world gives, but it's my peace that He provides. But you know what? We appropriate that promise, and what happens? Almost immediately, when we're seeking the Lord for His peace and for that peace that we need, I mean, things get three times as bad as they used to be. And oftentimes, we get real discouraged. We start feeling bad and feeling sorry for ourselves. And we start saying, man, I don't get peace. You know, some people get peace, but I don't ever get any peace. And then we start this terrible downward spiral because we're Americans, and Americans are consumers, and consumers are expecting to be able to get whatever they put their change in the slot for the vending machine. And we look at the truths and the propositional promises of God as though they're a vending machine, and they're not. What they are is a map of a battle that's taking place. And when we look at that promise that he's provided there for us for peace, we need to realize that what we're looking at is a spot on a map that is territory that has to be taken. And we need to pray. We need to get before the Lord as Isaac did. We got to beseech God for these things and call upon Him to help, because we can't move the impedances. Isaac and Rebekah, they couldn't make, you know, the child be conceived on their own. They, you know, obviously, I'm sure they, you know, knew how that worked, and obviously it wasn't working, and so what could they do about it? They didn't have fertilization clinics back in those days. They had to seek the Lord. They had to find out, they had to find God's faithfulness by seeking after it, trusting Him to provide, seeking His provision. It's an important thing to remember. I can't stress that enough, and I feel it strongly in my heart, my spirit. We need to be praying to God and trusting Him to provide these things, believing Him. Verses 22 and 23 then. I'm sorry, back in 21, I don't know if I even finished that, did I? But the Lord granted his plea, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. So the Lord did provide for them. Verse 22, but the children struggled together within her. And she said, if all is well, why am I like this? And so she went to inquire of the Lord. And the Lord said to her, two nations are in your womb, two people shall be separated from your body. One people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger. So here God has answered their request. They besought God for the promise to come to pass in their life. God answers Rebekah, and she's with child. But again, still the struggle continues. Even after they begin to get the answer and they see a light at the end of the tunnel, all of a sudden now, you know, she's going, man, if I'm well, then why am I like this? You know, clearly there's a problem pregnancy involved in this. I mean, this isn't just normal baby kickings, I'm sure. You know, of course, I've never had twins, and that's a wonderful thing. But I've never had children, and that's a wonderful thing. Anyway, beyond all that, you know, so here she's in a situation where she's faced again then with turmoil and confusion. You know, there's turmoil inside her, and she's confused about it. She's perplexed by it. You know, if I'm okay, then why is this happening? What's going on here? And it's interesting to me, again, as I look at this and I seek the Lord as to how to apply this passage to my own life. You know, again, I see how quick we are as human beings at least I think about my own life, how quick we are to panic. You know, something is going wrong. Something isn't working right. We suddenly find ourselves in turmoil, and we're confused about it. We don't know why it's happening or what's going on, and we just have a tendency to want to panic. We're slow, really, to inquire of God. We may spend a few moments praying because we know it's the right thing to do, saying, oh, God, why is this happening? But by and large, we're running around pulling our hair out, trying to figure out how to make this stop, what's going to make it stop, and looking for someone to help. And we'll inquire of all kinds of people. We'll go to experts after expert to find out what we can do to solve our dilemma, whether, you know, it's a physical issue or whether it's a emotional issue or a financial issue or whatever it is. I mean, we'll go to people all the time to talk to them, to get their advice, to find out why this or that is happening. I'm amazed, you know, and it's not a problem or anything, but I'm amazed sometimes when people have come to me and there's been a problem or they're in turmoil about something, and I'll ask them, well, have you prayed about this? Have you, you know, sought the Lord on this? And you'd be surprised how many people have said, well, no, not really. I'm just too upset. I can't pray. And I got to tell you, that's an amazing thing to me. Because if it were turned around, I would be definitely at least the second person that I would want to talk to, not the first. First person that we need to be inquiring of, like Sarah did here, the first person we need to be looking to is the Lord. I'm not saying that to discourage anybody from coming to talk to me. That's why I'm here, and I want, you know, that's why I'm here. I want to be able to talk things through and pray with people and stuff, but I should not be the first person on the list. The first person on the list should definitely, by all means, be Jesus. Asking Him, Lord, what is this? How can I know what this is all about? Sarah, man, things were wigging out for her physically with her body and stuff, and she went to the Lord, and clearly there had to be some time spent there, even in the midst of her turmoil and her confusion, clearly some time spent there listening for what the Lord might say. And then she heard something. She even heard, what's happening here? You're going to have twins. There's going to be two nations. It's amazing things that are taking place there within you. So it's one of those things. We need to, you know, we need to pray to appropriate the promises, but even when we appropriate the promises and the struggle continues, which it will, we need to inquire the Lord and continue to pray and seek Him and believe Him to provide the answer that we need and the peace that we need and the understanding. You know, and this is interesting because the Lord provides some understanding to her, provides some clearer picture of what's taking place in her own body, but it doesn't necessarily alleviate the turmoil that she's going through. It doesn't say anything about, you know, and then all of a sudden it all stopped and she felt a lot better. No, it doesn't say anything like that at all. So she might have had a, you know, a problem pregnancy all the way through, and but she at least had a peace of mind from the Lord as to what was taking place. And those are the things we need to remember in this, you know, that the Lord will provide for us some sense of peace in it. It may not even be as clear of an understanding as Rebecca was able to get there, but just to know that the Lord is looking after us. Maybe He'll just provide for us that sense of peace, of the knowledge that He's there and that He cares, that He's watching over us, that He's got all things under control. Well, let's keep reading here, verses 24 to 27. So when her days were fulfilled, in other words, the pregnancy has come to its culmination, the days were fulfilled for her to give birth. Indeed, there were twins in her womb. And the first came out red. He was like a hairy garment all over. So they called his name Esau. Afterwards, his brother came out. His hand took a hold of Esau's heel. So his name was called Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when she bore them. So the boys grew, and Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field. But Jacob was a mild man, dwelling in tents. Let's stop there, actually. Esau either means hairy, or it can also mean red. So Esau probably was a pretty ugly kid based on, you know, the description here. I mean, it's one of those things, if the dad's nearby, it's like, ugh! But either way, never mind. My kids, I was there when all of my kids were born, and I got to tell you, there was nothing more hideous than the sight of my kids when they were born. They were just, but that's just the way guys respond. Women don't, and you're all looking at me like, how could you say such a thing? But the fact is, they look like lizards. I mean, they're just weird looking. But you know, this kid really looked extra ugly or something. Jacob means one who holds the heel, or one who trips another. And it's interesting how his name just follows suit, you know, with who he is. You know, there's obviously physical reasons why they named Esau what they named him, but Jacob, it goes even beyond just the thing that they saw happening there when he held onto the heel of his brother when he was being born, but it goes on to the characteristics of his life later on. It's an amazing thing how even in the midst of what seem like just ordinary circumstances and the mundane things, that God can actually speak. You know, we need to be paying attention to His voice, because He can show up in all kinds of interesting places and interesting ways, and how just the naming of this child can end up being something as prophetic as it is. It's a wonderful thing to me. So these kids grow up, they're twins, but they end up being really opposite of each other in their characteristics. One guy is a real manly man, and the other guy ends up kind of being a mama's boy. And we even see that the parents, you know, sort of pick favorites with them. You know, you've got in verse 28, it says, "And Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game, but Rebekah loved Jacob." So, you know, you got the whole thing there. We got the parents sort of picking favorites between them. Isaac likes his young man who goes out and hunts and he cooks good barbecue and he just enjoys hanging out with him and watching the game with him and stuff. And Jacob's a little sensitive guy and he kind of likes to hang out with his mom and cook and do all those kind of neat little things that they like to do and stuff. And so mom, of course, just thinks, man, I like Jacob. He's nice, but Esau's rough and mean. Ugh. And, you know, it's just interesting. It's interesting, though, how God chooses. Romans chapter 9, we looked at that when we were doing our study in the book of Romans. And you know me, I'm not someone who believes in the doctrine of predestination as the Calvinists teach it, but I do believe that there's a choice that God made here concerning Jacob. And he chose Jacob over Esau for this specific thing. It wasn't an issue when he's dealing with it in salvation. He's not talking about salvation in Romans. But he's talking about the special purposes of God at this point, and he chose Jacob. And you think about it, I mean, to be honest with you, Jacob wouldn't be, you know, at least my choice. You wouldn't sit around and think, I want the kid who's on the cooking show. No, I want the guy who's going to be able to handle matters and get out and use a bow and arrow and a knife and stuff. You want somebody who's a go-getter. But God's choices are completely up to him, and he knows exactly what's going on. And actually, as we see these two young men develop, we see that there are characteristics that are quite honorable and good about Jacob as his life unfolds. He kind of goes up and down with his moral characteristics at times, and yet he's a guy who is sensitive to the Lord and willing to change and willing to bend and be corrected by God. So it's interesting. Before they had done, either good or bad, according to Romans, God chose the one. He rejected the other for these special purposes, for this line to carry on. And so, of course, there are two nations that come about. And that's all in Israel's history. Esau becomes the father of the Edomites, and the Edomites split off from Israel, and they were a nation all the way up until the first century AD, and then they just disappear from the face of the earth altogether. We don't know anything about them after that. But, well, let's continue on here. We'll get the final part of this story, verses 29 to 34. Now Jacob cooked a stew, and Esau came in from the field, and he was weary. And Esau said to Jacob, "Please feed me with that same red stew, for I'm weary." Therefore his name was called Edom. In other words, you could say, no wonder they called him Edom. Edom means red. You know, he wants the red stew. Verse 31, "But Jacob said, 'Sell me your birthright as of this day.' And Esau said, 'Look, I'm about to die, so what is his birthright to me?' Then Jacob said, 'Swear to me as on this day.' So he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. And Jacob gave Esau bread and stew of lentils, bean soup basically. And he ate and drank, arose, and went his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright." This is a familiar story to us. I'm sure anyone who's ever been in Sunday school for any period of time in their life is familiar with this. It's always used as an example of impetuousness, of jumping ahead of things, of desiring to gratify, to a desire for immediate gratification. Jacob's doing some cooking. You know, that's what he does. He's hanging out, cooking a nice stew, nice lentil stew. It must have smelled good. Esau's been out hunting, and the impression that you get from this is that he's been out hunting for a long period of time. He's hungry. Comes back, obviously hasn't had enough provisions with him or whatever it is. He's hungry, and he smells this good smell, and he's just wanting something to eat to be able to gratify that hunger that he's got right off the bat. And so he's ready to be tempted by this food. Isn't this interesting? I mean, we just looked at Matthew chapter 4 on Sunday, where Jesus is tempted. The very first temptation that he's faced with is a temptation for food. And we know that back in the Garden of Eden, the temptation that tripped up mankind was a temptation for food. So clearly the message is food is evil, so I'm going to quit eating. No, I'm just kidding. But the point is it comes back to those basic desires of of humanity, that desire to satisfy our appetite. There's nothing wrong with an appetite, but there is something wrong when the appetite rules us and when we don't allow the things of heaven and the issues of the kingdom of God to be the things which dictate and direct how we live our lives. So food is used as a temptation here, and the birthright is what's at stake. And the birthright is talking about the rights that go to a firstborn son. Remember, Esau is the first one who's born in this family. And so the firstborn gets a double portion of every part of the blessing. And that's what it was up at stake here. The double portion of the blessing of the inheritance of this vast and wealthy nomadic empire that was out there in the wilderness in this area of the promised land. But it wasn't just this double portion of stuff. It was actually also then the responsibility for caring for the family and the servants and the stuff that was there. And it is possible, just to kind of defend Jacob just a little bit, it is possible that Jacob looked at Esau and was thinking, is this guy going to be able to handle this kind of responsibility? I mean, this guy's pretty busy. He's out hunting all the time, lifting weights and stuff, going to games all the time. Is he really going to be able to handle the responsibility of caring for the needs of this family? Because Jacob apparently was a meticulous kind of guy. He was looking at it. He was good at cooking and recipes and all that kind of stuff. And he had a sense of responsibility, at least about that. It's possible. We don't know that for sure. But it's possible that might have been going through his mind. But Hebrews chapter 12 points to this passage and uses it, the writer of Hebrews uses it as a warning to us to be careful that we don't fall into this snare that Esau fell into. In fact, he actually puts it a lot more sternly than that, but at some point read Hebrews chapter 12. But the lesson to be learned from it is not prioritizing the temporal over the things of the kingdom of God. And that's what the writer there is talking about in the context of alerting people that sometimes we go through things because God as a father is correcting us and guiding us and leading us. He goes on to say, don't allow a heart like Esau's to develop in you. Be careful that there's none among you, he says, that are like Esau, who sold his birthright and then couldn't regain it later on, even with tears. We'll see that in chapter 27. You know, it's an interesting thing here to realize what is being presented here. There is this temptation. It's something that each one of us live with on a regular basis, especially in our culture. This temptation to live for the moment as opposed to prioritizing those things that are eternal in their nature. You know, every one of us is faced with those kind of things all the time. We're faced with them wherever we are. The temptation to seize the moment, you know, carpe diem, seize the moment, live for this moment right now, do it, take it, whatever it is. If it feels good, jump on it and go for it. Because, man, this is all you got. You only go around once in life. You need to grab a hold of whatever's there. And I got to tell you, that's not the attitude of the heart of the Lord at all. Well, there's a certain element where we need to have a willingness to be risky and adventurous for God. But that doesn't mean that we sit there and grab a hold of whatever is going to satisfy our appetites at the moment, thinking that that's going to satisfy us in some way. So many men, so many women have fallen because they allowed their desires for temporal satisfaction, immediate gratification of whatever appetite they had, to rule over them. And men have affairs or women have affairs or people cheat at their work and do illegal things thinking, man, I can get a hold of this. I can have this right now if I do this. But the price is always drastic and terrible. And the price was terrible for Esau. And I don't want to jump too far ahead, but when we get to chapter 27 and this plays itself out, he has lost his birthright and then Jacob usurps his blessing and Esau is weeping bitterly because there's nothing left for him. Because his mind was on those things that were going to gratify his flesh right at the moment. His mind was not on the importance and the value of what God had provided for him. You know, that's what our enemy is about. That's what our enemy is trying to do all the time. And as you watch TV or you listen to music or you're reading ads, you know, and we point to things like that and say, hey, you can hear God speak through those things. You know, it's not the scriptures or anything like that, but you can see and recognize that there are elements of the gospel that are encoded on man. But I'll tell you, That's the only way to look at them, because there's another message that's on the surface, that's right there, right out in front. And that message is designed to try to take our eyes off of the eternal things and the things of value. And they try to prioritize the things of flesh. That's why when we do point to movies or whatever, saying that the gospel message is there, we always want to remind you that the conclusions and the concepts that Hollywood comes to, though, are always wrong. You know, they build these romance stories or whatever, and we can look at it and say, wow, there's an analogy for the gospel in that. But the conclusion that's come to on the surface meaning of those things is always wrong. They always have the idea that, man, if I have the right romance, if I have the right boyfriend or the right girlfriend or the right kind of gun or whatever, I can win the day and everything's going to be all right and everything's going to be good for me. And that's not true. That's the message of this culture. That's the message of our enemy, to get our minds off of what's truly of value, and that is the stuff of heaven, the things that are eternal in their nature, the things that will never die. Jesus said, don't store up a bunch of stuff here, regardless of what these knuckleheads down here say. Don't store up stuff here, because moths eat it up and rust corrupts it and thieves break in and steal it, but rather store up stuff that's in heaven. Store up stuff in the presence of God, in an eternal dwelling place where we'll enjoy life with Him forever, with a satisfaction like we've never known. So what Esau did was take his eyes off of what was truly of value, those things of eternal nature. He focused his attention on his immediate appetite and the gratification of that appetite at the moment. And he missed out terribly. And it's a serious lesson. And it's a serious thing for us to take to heart and to remember in our own lives. Not to allow the enemy to trick us or deceive us like he did our parents back in Eden. But to listen to the voice of the Holy Spirit and listen to His promptings and remember who we truly are and what we truly yearn for and long for. And it's not the stuff of this earth. Is that cool?